This is VOA News via remote. I'm Diane Roberts. More emergency medical aid from foreign donors arrived in India Sunday to alleviate a dire oxygen shortage as COVID-19 deaths in the South Asian nation rose to a new record. India is setting almost daily records for new infections and deaths as the virus crisis engulfs outstretched hospitals and cities and spreads into rural regions. The country of 1.3 billion has reported more than 215,000 total deaths and more than 19.5 million cases. The latest figures came as medical equipment, including oxygen generation plants, was flown into the capital, New Delhi, from France and Germany as part of a huge international effort. Hundreds of Brazilians took to the streets of Sao Paulo Saturday to show their support for President Jair Bolsonaro, who's been criticized for his handling of the pandemic. Anti-Bolsonaro protesters also took to nearby streets, but in smaller numbers. New cases in Brazil have fallen off a late March peak, but remain high by historical standards. Total deaths in the country are second only to the United States. Nigeria will ban travelers coming from India, Brazil, and Turkey because of concerns about the rampant spread of coronavirus in those countries, a presidential committee said Sunday. The statement said the ban will take effect starting May 4th. Saudi Arabia, though, will lift its suspension on citizens traveling abroad and open land, sea, and air borders Monday, May 17th, the Interior Ministry said in a statement Sunday. Saudi citizens who have received two vaccination shots or one shot at least 2 weeks prior to travel, those who have recovered from coronavirus within the past 6 months, and those under 18 can travel. This is VOA News. A senior British Conservative broke ranks Sunday to call for Prime Minister Boris Johnson's resignation if it is proven that he broke government rules over the funding of a lavish revamp of his Downing Street flat. The call from Douglas Ross, leader of the Conservatives in Scotland, came as new opinion polls showed the ruling party's lead over the main opposition Labour Party has been slashed ahead of British local elections Thursday. Meanwhile, British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab said Sunday he had no idea if a Conservative Party donor had been asked to pay for child care for Prime Minister Johnson's son. The Sunday Times reported a British lawmaker had received a complaint from a Conservative Party donor that they were asked to foot the bill for a nanny for the child. Myanmar security forces opened fire on some of the biggest protests against military rule in days, killing at least 5 people, Sunday media reported, 3 months after a coup plunged the country into crisis. The protests were coordinated with demonstrations in Myanmar communities around the world to mark what organizers called the Global Myanmar Spring Revolution. They came after a spell of dwindling crowds and what appeared to be more restraint by security forces. Streams of demonstrators, some led by Buddhist monks, made their way through cities and towns across the country. Chad's new ruling junta announced Sunday it had lifted a curfew introduced after the shocking death of longtime leader Idriss Deby and the installation of a military council led by his son. An overnight curfew barring people from leaving their homes between 6 p.m. and 5 a.m. was introduced April 20th, hours after the military announced that Deby had died from wounds sustained by fighting with rebel forces. A decree signed by the military council's spokesperson said the curfew had been lifted after evaluating the steps initially taken by the transitional military council across the country and the security situation, end quote. Iran's foreign minister apologized Sunday for recorded comments that were leaked to the public last week, creating a firestorm in Iran less than 2 months before presidential elections. The recordings of Mohammad Javad Zarif criticizes the late Iranian general Qasem Soleimani's separate relations with Russia.
So we have visual confirmation of the Crew-1 resilience capsule.
From resilience. That is excellent news. We are splashed down.
And with that, 4 astronauts returned safely to Earth from the International Space Station early Sunday in a SpaceX Crew Dragon capsule parachuting to splash down in the Gulf of Mexico, NASA said. It was an express trip home lasting just 6.5 hours for the capsule, dubbed Resilience by the crew. I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Completely, the Zambian people are fatigued with this bad economy and also the unemployment level that this country is facing. The economy is bad. Everything is on higher price.
A prominent Zambian opposition figure defects to the governing party.
We know what is happening in any local community and we can advise accordingly. They are connected in this WhatsApp group and they are sharing their work, their success stories, as well as their challenges, and getting feedback and support from each other.
A Cameroonian NGO launches a project to strengthen the grassroots participation of women in peace and security through community awareness training.
I'm very, very concerned that they could be attacked and massacred where they are. And it has happened twice to us. In the history, it doesn't look good. So we don't want the history to repeat them itself. That is why we're reminding them, we are petitioning them to do something different this time.
Our leaders of the Mahoro Peace Association petitioned the UN Secretary General and heads of state in the Great Lakes region to help stop violence targeting the Banyamulenge ethnic group. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Zambia, a prominent opposition figure has announced his defection to the ruling Patriotic Front, or PF. Chishimba Kambwili, leader of the National Democratic Congress, or NDC, resigned from the opposition party a day before joining the ranks of the ruling party. He says he will become a common member of his new party. Kambwili had previously maintained he was one of the five founding members of the PF before a fallout with President Edgar Lungu led to his resignation to form the NDC. The sudden resignation makes Kambwili the second prominent opposition figure to defect to the PF ahead of the upcoming August 12 presidential and legislative elections. It comes weeks after Charles Kakoma, the former spokesperson of the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, announced his defection. Analysts say they expect more high-profile defections from the opposition parties to the ruling party. They add that if the trend continues, it will be difficult for the opposition groups to pose any significant electoral threat to the PF. For reaction to Mr. Kambwili's resignation and subsequent defection to the ruling party, I reach attorney Emmanuel Malite, media director for the opposition NDC.
This has not come as a surprise to our party, the NDC. And, you know, from the formulation of NDC, it was a radical political party led by Dr. Chishimba Kambwili, which was so radical and critical for the government in terms of providing checks and balance. But, you know, the African politics, the ruling party had to go for his personal attacks. The man is literally having four court cases that has been put on defense. So that resignation for him is just for him to survive personally and the family, and not that willingly he wanted. He tries not to work with the government of the day, he will be sent to jail. Because the PF government did not spare his business, did not spare his personal life. They had to put him in a lot of trumped up charges that he is still facing in court. So his decision right now is merely for him to survive politically and also otherwise, even the family. But suffice to say, where is the NDC going from now? The NDC has entered an agreement with the UPND, and we are in the UPND alliance, and we are forging ahead. It's unfortunate that he's not going to be part of this revolution that is coming in 12 August. General election.
So, Emmanuel, where does the NDC go from here?
Will you remain in alliance with the UPND, the main opposition party, and have Hakainde Hichilema as your presidential candidate in the upcoming general election?
Of course, our route is the UPND alliance. We've already signed up an agreement, and everything we're having, even our members being adopted to stand in as on ward level and parliamentary level. About 30% of the whole opposition of the whole stake has been given to the NDC to field in its own candidates, but they will still stand on the UPND. Well, they will still remain our member, but they will still stand on the UPND. And we are all putting our heads and our votes on the UPND president, President HH, Hakainde Hichilema.
How are your supporters reacting following news of the resignation of Chishimba Kambuli from your party and subsequently defecting to the Patriotic Front Party to, as he says, to become a common floor member there?
The reaction of the general membership of the NDC is, yes, of course, we are so disappointed. And it has come as something that would look a wake up call that the PF to govern this country does not even mean well. Anyone that challenges them, they become a casualty. But for the NDC membership itself, we are intact and we are forging ahead to make sure that they remove the PF in government.
What do you think the chances are for this opposition alliance between your party and UPND to defeat the Patriotic Front in the upcoming elections?
With all fairness, and if Zambia would go into a free and fair election, the opposition alliance, which is the UPND alliance, is standing even at 90-80% winning with a landslide, because completely the Zambian people are fatigued with this bad economy and also the unemployment level that this country is facing. The economy is bad. Everything is on higher price.
Attorney Emmanuel Milite is the media director for the opposition NDC. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. In Cameroon, the Center for Advocacy in Gender Equality and Action for Development has launched a project to strengthen the grassroots participation of women in peace and security through community awareness training. It's part of the center's efforts to help resolve the ongoing conflict in the mainly English-speaking parts of the country. Separatists in Western Cameroon are fighting for independence from the central government, which has been led for decades by French speakers. The center's training aims to empower women to effectively participate in the prevention, management, and resolution of conflict. Human rights groups say the violence between Anglophone rebels and the military has left over 3,000 people dead and over 1 million displaced from their homes. Clotilda Andiensa is the CEO of the center, which is based in Bamenda. She tells me that project participants are being trained to improve their communication skills and learning how to maintain neutrality in conflict resolution.
We are presently actually training community peace ambassadors who are intervening in their local communities with this particular instrument. We have trained already 30, that is 10 men and 20 women, and we have certified them and handed over a community handbook, which is a simplified version of the international instrument, because we've made it in a way that they can easily use it and adapt it to their communities.
What are some of the activities that you take these young women through to help equip them regarding capacity building to help them be effective in their communities where the conflict is still raging?
We provide them with basic needs. We provide a training on psychological, and we offer also psychosocial support. We also improve their skills on communication, and improve their knowledge on the principle of neutrality. We also help them to be better ambassadors of peace and nothing but peace, because we provide them with knowledge on international instruments like what we have just done on Resolution 1325. We are giving them a handbook, which is a tool that they are going down to use. We have certified them. They have a certificate that supports their work in the communities. And we continuously monitor and provide assistance to them as they carry out this work in their various communities.
With the training that these young men and women are undergoing, how effective do you think they will be in helping to end the conflict?
With this training, we expect both of them to be able to mainstream what they have learned, taking into account and into consideration how the conflict is affecting both genders. We are very happy because the male trainees in particular have had the opportunity to understand what the women go through, and also to see how they can effectively collaborate to see that this happened. It is the same thing with the women. They are also happy that for once they have the opportunity to speak out with people in a kind of a level ground who are now understanding their challenges. We understand that out there, the people who are at the forefront of the crisis or the conflict are also both men and women. So having these trainees going down there as mediation activists, they are meeting their kind. And it's but normal that when a man talks to a man and a woman talks to a woman, and both of them mix, it gives us exactly what we want.
How does the organization monitor the progress of these trained men and women? What are some of the mechanisms implemented in order to be effective in monitoring their progress in helping to stop this conflict?
One of the strategies that we are maintaining on ground is the formation of peace clubs. So each of these community peace ambassadors is going back to form a peace club in his or her community that will constitute at least 10 members. In this club, they will be able to pass on the lessons that we have impacted on them at this level. Talking about how we intend to follow up these clubs, we have a harmonized action plan, which each club will adopt. One other strategy we are also adopting is that we are already in a one big WhatsApp group where we actually communicate on daily basis. So at any moment, we know what is happening in any local community and we can advise accordingly. They are connected in this WhatsApp group and they are sharing their work, their success stories, as well as their challenges, and getting feedback and support from each other.
Clotilda Andienza is the CEO of the Center for Advocacy in Gender Equality and Action for Development. She spoke with me from Bamenda, Cameroon. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, leaders of an NGO called the Maharu Peace Association have petitioned UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and heads of state in the Great Lakes region to help stop violence targeting the Banyamulenge ethnic group. The association says the attacks against the group appears to be ethnic cleansing. This after local media report a surge in violence in areas predominantly inhabited by communities of the group. The report also says the ongoing violence and killings have forced tens of thousands of civilians to flee their homes and have sharply increased the numbers of internally displaced persons. The NGO blames Mai Mai militia groups, foreign fighters, and elements of the National Army, the AFRDC, for the attacks against their unarmed Banyamulenge communities. But army officials deny any involvement in violence. They say they routinely repair rebel attacks to protect the population. Adele Kibasumba, president of the Mahoro Peace Association, signed the petition. She tells me that the ongoing ethnic cleansing targeting the Banyamulenge is unacceptable. She also calls on the international community to act quickly to stop the bloodshed.
This petition is really because there is this new area that has been completely destroyed. And we have a mass displacement of people, nearly 3,000 people we have registered who have already been displaced, and they have reached this area in the territory of Uvira called Boigera, who have no protection from the MONUSCO, from the government. Some of them are still missing. We don't know how many people die yet because some people are still missing. And we are very worried of this displacement of people in one area, 3,000 people in one area. And from our past experience, whenever the Banyamulenge had flee conflict like this and they have been resettled in one area, that means they're very exposed to massacres. And that's the case of Gatumba. Myself, I'm a survivor of that. And it's a case also for the Mikenke, where last year, the displaced people under the UN protection, again, the camp was attacked. We are very concerned that this could also happen again on top of already, the mass fleeing of people. But where they are, we are very concerned of their security.
But the government is saying that, well, they have put in effort, including, you know, getting help from MONUSCO as well as the AFRDC to try to resolve some of these concerns you are expressing. Why do you disagree that the government is doing enough about this?
Well, I disagree because one of the initiatives that the government has done was the inter-community dialogue. And that has happened for the past 2 years. But they have been unsuccessful. That is their, it has been their strategy to resolve the conflict, plus the military interventions. So the dialogues had failed. The military interventions, you have military leaders who have been complicit and sometimes being on the side of attackers and sometimes handing over ammunition to my mind. Those things have happened.
People say those things are just mere allegations, that there's no proof of that.
We do have proof of it, and it has been documented by the UN group of experts and other monitoring agencies in the region. So we do have proof of that, and it has happened. We actually have called for some of those commanders to be sanctioned, let alone be muted and taken to other places, but those commanders are still in Minembwe, for example. And one more thing, with the new conflict in Uvira territory, which is far from Minembwe, you have an area of 150 kilometers that was attacked, and there was no FRDC to be seen, no MONUSCO to be seen. And the attackers came, burned the villages, took over all the herds, the cattle, and they chased out the villagers, those who were able to escaped. But you see, there's no interventions really. So I'm not sure who said and what they said that they have done. They have not done not enough.
What can the UN Secretary General do, coupled with what you are asking for, the international community's intervention to stop this conflict? What can these two organizations do?
Well, the reason why we continue to petition them, it is one of the MONUSCO is one of the biggest peacekeeping mission on their plate, really. And they are the ones that are tasked to make sure the civilians are safe. We are just we're reminding them, because this is it's within their agenda. So even though we know that in the past petition they haven't done anything, but there's still time. Those 3,000 people need to be protected where they are. They need food and shelter. They need medical supplies, and they need to also return home. So somehow this other place that is now near their home that are empty and burned, somehow the government need to send a military deployment there and make sure that they chase out all the Mai Mais and the foreign forces. MONUSCO needs to ensure that people can safely return. I don't think that's going to happen soon, but at least they can secure the civilians where they are right now. in Bwegera. They need food. They need protection. I'm very, very concerned that they could be attacked and massacred where they are. And it has happened twice to us. In the history, it doesn't look good. So we don't want the history to repeat them itself. That is why we're reminding them. We are petitioning them to do something different this time.
Adele Kibasumba is the president of the Mahoro Peace Association. She spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Ghana's President Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo is expected to kick off the construction of the Pan-African Heritage World Museum. The ceremony will be held on the grounds of the museum located in Winneba, a city in the country's central region. The event coincides with Africa's World Heritage Day Wednesday. Kojo Yanka, the founder of the African University College of Communications, is the founder of the new institution, which he says is dedicated to sharing the story of Africa and its people. Its vision, Mr. Yanka adds, is to curate, preserve, and communicate the history, ideals, philosophy, and the cultural heritage of the people of African descent. Construction of the museum is expected to be completed before the official commissioning in July 2023. For more about Wednesday's opening ceremony and the significance of the museum, I reach Mr. Kojo Yanka in the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
Yes, the significance of it is very clear. The President of the Republic of Ghana, who did the official virtual launch in September last year, has agreed to do the sword cutting. The importance of it is that it emphasizes the commitment of government of Ghana to support this project. The Minister for Tourism is also coming, and it gives a signal to the rest of our constituents that indeed the project is real and it's coming on. The President will definitely announce government support, and it will ginger a lot of interest in other donors in various parts of the world to contribute to the project. We think that the construction should take not more than 2 years, so that come July 2023, we will commission this museum.
What impact do you think this museum is going to have on not only Africans and Ghanaians, but the international community? Black people in the international community or in the diaspora?
I must say that it has already started making waves in various parts of Africa and the diaspora. And we are getting tons of emails and through our website, through telephone calls about interest in this project because we know that a lot of people are hungry for the real history of Africa. Written by Africans and also covering not just the continent of Africa, but for all parts of the world where people of African descent live. So now we have contacts in Brazil, in Puerto Rico, in Colombia, even in some parts of India and Turkey, where people, most people do not know that there's still a population of descendants of Africans living there. So it's amazing how this project has generated so much interest around the world. Their significance in African society and the contribution that herbal plants are making to the health delivery system of Africa, and of course, how we can also undertake scientific research into all of them. We have a group of herbal scientists that are from across Africa and from the Caribbean who are just studying that and getting that space also ready. And then we have the Pan-African Heroes Park, where heroes, not just of Ghana, not just of the continent, but some of the heroes in the various, diasporan, countries like in the Caribbean, in South America, some of those who did heroic things there, starting a revolution against indecency and against the way they have been treated and so on in Jamaica, in Haiti, in Trinidad, Tobago, in Barbados, all across the diasporan world. So this is a very exciting project and everybody is waiting. I you know, I get calls from all over the world, and everybody is anxious that this project should come on, and they will all be here in Ghana to see it, particularly when we get to the commissioning stage.
What is your message to the black people around the world with this project once it's complete?
The message is clear that let's all note that we have one heritage. There is no doubt about it. We'll find out, you know, from this project that we have one heritage. From all that we will see there, from the opportunities that we will grant for conferences, meetings, there will be accommodation there for all kinds of festivals involving, you know, people from various parts of the world. But so telling them that we have a common heritage, the idea that we got separated, it's not our fault. Let's all get together, and that when we educate ourselves, heal ourselves, we will then end up inspiring ourselves. At the end of the day, I would want people who come visit the site to get inspired to now build new resolutions for a better society.
Kojo Yanka is the founder of the Africa University College of Communications and is also the founder of the new institution. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, Siafi No, a Sierra Leonean immigrant, says she plans to soon announce her candidacy for a seat on the Prince George's County Council District 3 in the eastern U.S. state of Maryland. She was a former candidate for District 24 in the State House of Delegates 3 years ago. She says lessons learned from her first attempt at the statewide office gives her the name recognition, opportunities, as well as support from the African community and beyond in her bid for another political office. Primaries for the PG County elections are scheduled for June 2022. Ms. Finot, a single mother, says she was motivated to run for office to ensure Africans in the country have a seat at the table in the community, which has a large African immigrant population. I reached Siafi Finot to learn more about her plans, motivation, and election prospects.
My motivation is we have to be represented. We have a very large population in Prince George's County. Prince George's County is very diverse. We have the largest African concentration. We are influential. We have the money. We are educated, but we are not represented. So me, as an African woman in America, I understand my role. My role is to lead and to direct, to educate and to stimulate and execute, you know, the fourth industrial revolution in Prince George's County, whereby, you know, we connect the wealth between, you know, Prince George's County and Africa.
Let me ask you, what makes you uniquely qualified to compete for this position?
I have a niche. I have a demographic that are looking up to me. Like I said, that are not represented at all. And me coming out as an African born, for me to stand and have the audacity to say I am going to run for office in America is so admirable to my people that they're willing to support me, to throw their money behind me so I can get in there and represent them and speak for them and represent them. And somebody that knows their plight. So that plight, I can represent them. I can hear them. I can understand, you know, the family that they have left back home, and they're here working day and night to support those family back home. I have been there. My parents have been there. That's how I was brought to America. And I'm not timid, you know, to speak on behalf of my family, with the accent in my mouth.
Realistically, what do you think your chances are to winning this election?
My chances are very high because, you know, I learned before 2018. You know, I didn't win, but I learned a valuable lesson. And now the people have known who I am, and that's how it is in politics. The first time you throw your hat in there, it's not to win, but to get your face and your name out there. And I have done both. in one time. I've put my face out there. I've put my name out there. So when you call Sia, people know who Sia is. I have the following. I have the niche. And the people themselves in America, the Americans themselves, have realized that I'm here and I have a voice. And my voice is a revolution to represent, you know, our people, especially, you know, the African diaspora, the women, you know, which is very special to me, because all my life, personal and political career, I've always been to empower women.
Sia, what is your polling director or your polling company telling you about how people are responding to your message?
You know, I've already told me that my community, my American community, my African community are in support of me. They know that I'm going to run, but I have not declared yet. And I'm having calls from everybody, everywhere, you know, from white, black, you know, African, you know, trying to see when I can, you know, declare my candidacy so they can start raising funds for me. So that alone gave me the courage that this time around, we are going to go in. And this is the time. And the time is right. It's perfect. I have this strong backing for that from my people. And especially you calling me, it's an honor, you know, for you to see my post and call me. It's a great honor for me.
What should residents in Prince George's County expect from Sia if they give you their mandate to represent them?
For me, like I said before, empowering women has always been part of my personal and professional platform. And I believe that when we liberate a woman, we liberate a whole continent. When we liberate women, we liberate a nation and a community. And I think it is important as Black women, African women, understand our role to give back to the community that we're raised. This is my community. I grew up here. You know, I am representing, you know, the first generation Africans and the Africans that came at the second generation. I want to create a better community for our children's children that are going to come after us. You know, as an African woman, you know, I have to, you know, be the leader. I have to lead. I have to be the leader of change. I have to represent the people well. And we are going to do it together. I'm not making any promises, but we are going to do it together. My role is to lead, you know, to be a social reformer, to innovate, to inspire other women to come with me and so we can, you know, create a better society, you know, for our children and our children.
Sia Afino was a former candidate for Maryland District 24 in the Maryland State House of Delegates. She spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The draw for the quarterfinal stages of the African Champions League and the Confederation Cup were held on Friday. Defending champions Al Ahly of Egypt and their South African coach will take on his former club, Mamelodi Sundowns. Holders Al Ahly against Mamelodi Sundowns will be interesting of the four quarterfinal ties to be played over successive weekends in May as they meet for the third successive time at this stage of the competition. In the other draws, Melodia Algas will play Wydad Casablanca, CR Belouizdad will face Esperance of Tunisia, and the Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa will play Simba of Tanzania. In the semi-final draw, the winner of Alga and Wydad will play the winner between Kaizer Chiefs and Simba, and the winner between Belouizdad and Esperance meet the winner between Al Ahly and Mamelodi Sundowns. In the Confederation Cup quarter-final draw, CS Sfaxien of Tunisia play JS Kabylie of Algeria, Orlando Pirates of South Africa meet Raja Casablanca of Morocco, Pyramids of Egypt play Enyimba of Nigeria, and Cotton Sport of Cameroon take on Giraffe of Senegal. In the semi-final draw for the Confederation Cup, the winner between Cotton Sport and Giraffe play the winner between Sfaxien and JS Kabylie, and the winner between Pyramids and Enyimba meet the winner between Orlando Pirates and Raja Casablanca. Meanwhile, there are reports that the DR Congo Football Federation is appealing the eligibility of Gwela Kanga to play for Gabon. Gabon recently qualified for next year's Africa Cup of Nations ahead of DR Congo,
who finished third in Group D behind the Panthers and the table leaders, the Gambia. It's not yet known why DR Congo is challenging the right of Kanga to play for Gabon. Kanga first played for Gabon in 2012. If it's proven that Kanga is not eligible to play for Gabon, then CAF would strip the Panthers of all 10 points it earned from this Nations Cup qualifying campaign. That would move Gabon to bottom of Group D and push DR Congo to the top to qualify alongside the Gambia, who would now be runners-up with Angola moving to third. And the Sierra Leone Football Association, SLFA, might decide to appeal the Court of Arbitration for Sport over the abandoned 2021 Africa Cup of Nations qualifier against Benin. On Tuesday, CAF rejected Sierra Leone's claim they should be awarded the win for the game rather than it being rescheduled for June. The Group L tie was supposed to have taken place in Freetown in March, but was called off when Benin refused to play as they disputed five of its players returning positive COVID-19 tests that would have ruled them out of the match. A draw for Benin would be enough for them to go through to the finals, while Sierra Leone would need a 1-0 win or a two-goal margin of victory if they concede a goal. A qualification for Sierra Leone would end a 25-year wait of qualifying for Africa's number one football tournament for the West African nation. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Regrettably, the devastating repercussion of the COVID-19 virus pandemic warranted the suspension of my weekly commentary a year ago. However, with the adding of this dangerous repercussion, particularly in the United States, although not in all parts of the world, particularly in India and some other parts in Africa, attempts are being made now to resume this commentary. Among the devastating events occurring at the moment in the African continent, the evolving situation in the country of Chad needs to be reviewed. The people of Chad and the rest of the international community were shocked to discover that President Deby, who had just won another election, had sustained wounds in the front, defending the country against rebels, and that he had been brought into the capital in Yamena and had died. The opposition forces in Chad, while grieving with the family of the president, decided that this event, sad event, may be the harbinger of a new day in Chad. On the other side, the rebel forces said they would halt the advance and await developments in Chad. Then the strong military of Chad announced that it had decided to set aside the constitution of the country and then sent packing the parliament. It decided that it had formed a military council which will be headed by the son of President Deby. And added that the council will order fresh election in 18 months. It was a big surprise to the opposition forces. On their part, they were calling for a national dialogue to pave the way for a new civilian government in charge. What came later as a rude shock to the opposition forces in Chad was the decision of powerful outside forces who are pursuing their own national interests to endorse the decision of the Military Council, arguing that that would bring about stability in Chad. The opposition in Chad said that there being no stability in Chad during the long reign of President Bibi, and they totally objected to the arrangements being pursued. Now, why is it that the opposition said that this was a military coup? Let's look at the stubborn facts in Chad. Why did the military abolish the constitution? It did so perhaps because under the constitution of Chad, there were provisions for a smooth transition should the president pass away. In the absence of a nominee or appointee as a vice president, it should be the president of the National Assembly that should succeed President Bibi. But the military had its own ideas. For them to appoint the son of the president, who is now only 37 years old, you cannot uphold the Constitution, because the Constitution states that the minimum age for the head of state should be 45 years. So you could see why the opposition were clear in their minds that this was a military coup. On the question of stability, this has been a kind of standpoint of outside military forces when they want to maintain the influence in small and weak countries. The question then is, can you maintain stability in the country when the domestic situation is unstable? All evidence has shown throughout history that it is not possible. So you do have a clash of interests between outside forces and those within a country. It is very clear that those who may want to push the idea of stability for the military regime, and they have the power to do it, they clash with the interests of the domestic opposition. So this is a situation that may warrant the intervention of agents of the international community. Luckily, we have learned that the African Union has sent delegates that are now in charge examining the local situation. But the Security Council must also assist the African Union, because unless this matter is arrested quickly, we can see the escalation of hostility that has already cost many lives in Chad. And this is what is required at this serious, dangerous time in Chad. I thank you.
That was Wama's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
We all need love, we all need affection, and the way that you're looking at me, I can feel a connection. Unani bamba, baby, kwazo na bochekecha, kinywaji kwa mukono, na kibeti kwa bega. Napenda doho na matali pia tunazo drama. Ya dunia ni mengi sana. Noko miti miti mama. So nipe nafasi, nikupe mapenzi yangu ya kili ya. Haleluya.
need a wife wakuishi na yeye pata vijana takufa mapema magonjwa yameja jina langu ni sasa lazima nile nikikosa kula na wendo chakula takonda mazima and I believe nitakuwa na wewe mwanzo mpaka mwisho and I believe. Yeah.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impunga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if while climbing a tree you insist on going beyond the top, the earth will be waiting for you. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.